We're going to continue on in our study in Bible geography. In this area, we're very familiar with toll roads, right? We have most places you want to go. If you want to get there in an expedited way, there's probably a toll road to get there. And one of the things that I understand in the history of these toll roads, for example, the East-West Expressway that goes through Orlando. My understanding is when they built that expressway, they said, we're going to put tolls on it to start out with. And once we pay for the road, we'll take the toll booths off. I think they've probably paid for that road over and above a dozen times now. But the toll booths are still there, aren't they? Toll booths are still there. And what we know is that in our human world that, sometimes one person makes a commitment and the person who follows them said, I'm not bound by that commitment. I didn't make it. Or second, that person goes, you know, this cash flow on this toll road is awfully nice. We have this whole bureaucracy to support this toll road, and so we've got to keep all these people employed. And so, therefore, we're going to leave these tolls on, even though we told the voters that they vote for this, or, you know, we have a tax increase for this or whatever, that we'll take this off later. That often doesn't happen. But one of the wonderful things I think that we see, as we've talked about as we go through Bible geography, is that we find God doing what he says. In other words, we find God saying, I'm going to do this, and we see in the land the evidence of God doing those things. Okay, just as I said before last week, one of the values of this is to recognize that the stories in the Bible are not fairy tales, that you can go to the place and places where those things have taken place and see where it happened. All right, but the other thing is that you can go to that place and see where God has done what he said he was going to do. And we have a God who does what he says he's going to do, that his word does not return unto him void, that when he says, I'm going to, he does it, okay? Now, we can't have that confidence in human beings, can we? Sometimes, as human beings, there are people who are just dishonest, and they say they're going to do something, and they don't. Sometimes there are people who do their best to keep their commitment, but for whatever reason, because we're not God, we can't control every circumstance, and therefore we find that we aren't able to keep a commitment. And so, therefore, we're unable to do it. But God, both in his love and power, keeps his commitments. So we're going to look tonight at the Southern Hill Country. All right. But I want to consider first the Central Mountain Range area that we're going to look through. And there are here several areas that make up the Central Mountain Range. And we'll look at those on the map in just a minute. Let me go ahead and I'll just move down to the map here. Okay. So let's review these longitudinal zones that make up Israel. This area along here we call what? And remember, the coastal plain. Very good. And then through here, that's what we're going to study tonight. It's the hill country or the central mountain range. Okay, this area here, the Dead Sea, Jordan River, Sea of Galilee. Well, we have the Transjordan Mountains over here. This is the Rift Valley. So, very good. The Rift Valley, okay? And this is a rift that goes all the way from here way down into Kenya. And then we have over here the Transjordan Mountains. And then out here, Eastern Desert. That's the Eastern Desert, okay? So, as we study the land. Okay, so tonight we're going to look at part of the Central Mountain Range. Honestly, most of the events in the Bible take place in the Central Mountain Range. Most of what you know, obviously we've discovered some of them that took place in this coastal plain, and there are plenty that take place here in the Rift Valley as well. And this is going to border, some of this is going to border the Rift Valley. But many of the events in the Bible take place right through this Central Mountain Range, okay? And the first area in the Central Mountain Range is right here, okay? The central city to it is called Beersheba. It's called the Negev. And we'll get to the Negev tonight. Then the second section that we would look at is the hill country of Judah. That's right in here, okay? And we'll look at the major cities of that. Then just to the east of it is the wilderness of Judah. And you can see the difference between the green and the more desertish kind of wilderness setting there. Then you have the hill country of Ephraim and Manasseh in this area here, okay? As you move north, and these are named this because this is the inheritance of these tribes under Joshua and that God had given them. And then you have the Jezreel Valley, which goes through here, okay? And so that's a valley that sits in this hill country. A lot of important events took place in the Jezreel Valley. There's sometimes it's called well, some, the best known thing I think that most Christians know about it is that the Battle of Armageddon will take place there. Okay, and the city of Megiddo is, it controls the entrance to it on the west end of the valley. There are a lot of other things, though. You know, Gideon's battle takes place there. Josiah is killed in battle there. There's a bunch of other things that happen in the Bible that take place in the Jezreel Valley. So we get up into this area. This is the Galilee, okay? So that's the hills that Jesus grew up in. Nazareth is up in there, that area. That is the Galilee. So those are the areas of the Central Mountain Range. And as we go back here, we're going to see there are three areas of the southern hill country that we're going to look at. The Negev, the hill country of Judah, and the wilderness of Judah. So we'll move here. We can, again, get a stretch of Israel. You can see some of the political lines drawn there. But in modern Israel, Elath is way down here on the edge of the Red Sea. That's the furthest southern tip. Mount Hermon's up here in the north. And so the area we're going to be looking at is this area right through here. And so from the Galilee all the way down into the Negev here. And to give you an idea, okay, so here's the southern hill country. The inheritance of Simeon was down here in the south. The Negev's right in here. The hill country of Judah is obviously where Judah inherited. The Benjamin Plateau is in part of that. And then you can see where Ephraim and Manasseh's inheritance is north of there. All right. And then we'll start looking at our major cities here in just a minute. So let's consider the Negev, the boundaries of the Negev. The word Negev means either south or dry. The King James usually translates it as south. And again, I'll ask you to turn in your Bibles some here. We won't usually turn to the passages twice once we've looked at them, but I invite you to look at these passages. Genesis chapter 12, verse 9. This is the beginning of the story of Abraham. Verse 1 says, "Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee." And then when we get to verse 9, it says, "And Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south." And that word that's translated south there is the Hebrew word Negev. Okay? And it's, so it's a regional name. It would be much like we would use the word south in the United States. Okay? When you talk about the south, that's a particular region of the United States. Okay, and then in 13:1, "And Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the south." Okay, so if you don't understand that word south there, it's actually talking about a particular region. You're like, into the south of what? He didn't go into the south of Egypt. He went into the Negev. In modern Israel, the Negev extends from Beersheba to Elath. So as we had been looking before on that map, so in modern Israel, the Negev is from here to here. Okay. That's how they talk about the Negev today. In biblical times, primarily the Negev was, and I'm getting ahead of myself, was this area down around Beersheba in and around here. Okay. In biblical times, the Negev was sort of an hourglass-shaped basin with two loops coming together at the wedge of land at Beersheba, lying between the mountains of Judah to the north. So we have the hill country of Judah to the north of it, and the wilderness highlands to the south. And so you get some of this desertish area that goes further to the south of it. Rainfall in the Negev is small, about 8 to 12 inches annually, with deviations being common depending on yearly weather. Crops are marginal, okay? In the Negev, crops are marginal. 1 year in three or four will yield a good crop. The area is much better suited to pasturing sheep and goats. So why do you think that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob end up living in that area at times, especially Abraham and Isaac, because they have large flocks and they're not taking up somebody's arable farmland. Their crops aren't stomping all over somebody's wheat or barley, their flocks. And so their flocks are able to pasture in those areas. And it's an area that isn't really well suited to growing regular crops throughout the year. So the importance of the Negev, let's consider this. Abraham, Sarah, and Lot journeyed from the Negev to Egypt. We saw this in Genesis 12, 8 through 13. We looked at verse 9. And then in 13:2, "And Abram was very rich in cattle and in gold and in silver." Okay, 13:1, we had seen they'd gone into the south, into the Negev. So this is the area that a lot of Abraham's story takes place in, a lot of this area in the Negev. Abraham and Sarah stayed at Gerar on the western Negev. In Genesis 20 and 21, so maybe you remember this story. "And Abraham journeyed from thence toward the south country and dwelled between Kadesh and Shur and sojourned at Gerar." All right. And so Gerar was actually a Philistine city. It was up on the edge of the Negev. And they end up in the Gerar for a little while. And Abram said of Sarah, his wife, she is my sister. And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Now, what does he say? He says, she's my sister. Now, that's technically true. Okay? They had the same father, but a different mother. So, she was his half-sister. But she was his wife. And so he would have her say, she's my sister, so that he was afraid that men in various places he would go, she was beautiful, and that they would want to take her as a wife, and that they would kill him so they could steal her as a wife. So he would say, tell men that you're my sister, and that way, you know, they'll come to me and treat me better, and they won't try to kill me. Now, this is interesting, because that's not really a God-honoring way to deal with the truth, is it? All right? I mean, there are times in the Bible that we find people using, for example, a partial truth, and God allows them to do it. That happens in the case of Samuel. God tells Samuel to go anoint David in the book of 1 Samuel and says, you know, go down, stop mourning for Saul, and go down and anoint David. And he says, but if Saul hears about it, he's going to say, I'm a traitor. I'm anointing a new king of Israel. And the Lord says, well, tell them that you're going down to have a feast with the sons of Jesse, with Jesse and his household, which was true. That is what Samuel was going to do. And so that's a true statement, but he's not telling the whole truth. Well, why? Because God wanted that truth hidden from Saul because God had rejected Saul. Okay. But in this case, Abraham is withholding truth that these other men need to know. Okay. Something like the fact that he's married to this woman so that they don't try to take her as a wife. And what happens in these passages, we saw it happen in the book of Genesis once in Egypt with Pharaoh, and then here we find it in Gerar. And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. He says, hey, she's a good-looking woman. I want to add her to my harem. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, behold, thou art but a dead man for the woman which thou hast taken, for she is is a man's wife. But Abimelech had not come near to her, and he said, Lord, wilt thou slay also a righteous nation? So eventually what happens is Abimelech comes to Abraham and says, you know, why did you lie to me? Verse 11, and Abraham said, because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will slay me for my wife's sake. And yet indeed she is my sister, she is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. And it came to pass, when God caused me to wander from my father's house, that I said unto her, this is thy kindness, which thou shalt show unto me at every place whither we shall come. Say of me, he is my brother. And Abimelech took sheep and oxen and men servants and women servants and gave them unto Abraham and restored him Sarah his wife. Now this happens both times too. That Abraham, they have this lie that they tell, this half-truth that they tell. And at the end of it, God uses it to still enrich Abraham. Because God had promised to bless Abraham. Now, don't misunderstand something. I don't think this means that, you know, we should tell half-truths. But what we also recognize is that we're all sinners. And there are times that we make sinful choices. And that doesn't mean that just because I made a sinful choice that God is never going to do kindly to me or deal kindly with me. All right. And so that's not to excuse the sin. I'm not trying to do that. But what we do have to understand here is that, you know, God had a relationship with Abraham and he had promised to bless Abraham. And so here he uses even this very difficult situation. And you have to understand how important this is, because there are some important points of the Abrahamic covenant. Okay, he promises him in the Abrahamic covenant, I'm going to give to you and your descendants this land that I'm going to show you. Second, I'm going to make your descendants like the stars in the sky or the sand on the seashore. They're going to be innumerable. Third, I will bless those who bless you and I'll curse those who curse you. And fourth, through you all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And so that fourth one is a promise of the gospel. That is, the Messiah is going to come through you and we're all blessed through a descendant of Abraham, right? Through Jesus. And so what we see is God has made these promises to Abraham, but part of this promise implies, and God has told him this, that, you know, through Sarah, I'm going to give you a son, and that son is going to become a great nation. It's going to be Isaac. But if Sarah becomes another man's wife, it puts this whole promise into jeopardy, doesn't it? You see, the Lord has to intervene in this, because if the Lord doesn't intervene and doesn't rescue Sarah out of that situation, if she does have a child, there will be a huge question about who the father is. Okay? And in fact, this is the promise of God that in Sarah, who was barren, the Lord would make an offspring, a nation, a great nation. And so this is really, this is actually a gospel crisis in a sense. In other words, for all of us to be blessed through Abraham, God has to intervene in both the case with Pharaoh and with Abimelech, the king of Gerar here. Beersheba gets its name from the agreement that Abraham and Abimelech have at Gerar, Genesis 21:31. There's arguments about the wells. Verse 31, wherefore he called that place Beersheba, because there they swear both of them. Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba, and Abimelech rose up, and Philcol, the chief captain of the host, and they returned into the land of the Philistines. They have a covenant with each other not to fight over wells, and Abraham claims to have dug wells there, which he did, and so they make an agreement about those wells, and in the agreement about those wells, this place acquires that name, Beersheba. Okay? Isaac and his wife Rebekah lived in Beersheba, Genesis 24. So if we turn over a few chapters, Genesis 24:62. Verse 61, and Rebekah arose and her damsels, and they rode upon the camels and followed the man, and the servant took Rebekah and went his way. Now they had been up in, way up in Damascus area, past that, actually in Syria. So she has this long journey down to the south here. So they're way up over here in Syria, and they're going to make this journey down here to this area. And so she's on this journey, and what we find is Isaac came from the way of the well of Lahai-Roi, and dwelt in the south country, that is, in the Negev. And Isaac went out to meditate in the field at the eventide, and he lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold, the camels were coming. So Isaac goes out into the field to clear his mind, go for a walk, and he sees the camels of his father's servant coming. And Rebekah lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she lighted off the camel. For she had said unto the servant, what man is this that walketh in the field to meet us? And the servant had said, it is my master. Therefore she took a veil and covered herself. And the servant told Isaac all things that he had done. And Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent and took Rebekah, and she became his wife. And so what we find here is it's in this region that Isaac marries Rebekah. Okay. And we can go all the way through the next portion. We find more details about their life there in and around Beersheba and the Negev. The tribe of Simeon's inheritance was within the territory of Judah in the region of Beersheba, Joshua 19. So as we get to the book of Joshua, we went through the book of Joshua on Sunday evenings through earlier this year. We found that God gives the inheritance to the various tribes, to the land God had promised to Abraham. And here in Joshua chapter 19, we find Simeon's allotment. And the second lot came forth to Simeon, even for the tribe of the children of Simeon, according to their families and their inheritance, was within the inheritance of the children of Judah. And they had in their inheritance Beersheba and Sheba and Molada, etc. And we find this whole list of the places they inherit, and it is in that region of Beersheba. This becomes the inheritance of the tribe of Simeon. All right, David and his family stayed at Ziklag, which is just northwest of Beersheba, while he was separated from Saul and had joined the Philistines, 1 Samuel 30. So if we go a little further and we get to 1 Samuel 30, this is the region that Ziklag is in. And it came to pass when David and his men were come to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had invaded the south, see that phrase, the Negev, and Ziklag, and smitten Ziklag and burned it with fire. And had taken the women captive and were therein, etc., and slew not any, either great or small, but carried them away and went on their way. So then what David and his men do is they pursue them, and they are able to win their families back and able to get their, win actually extra riches in spoiling the Amalekites here. But the Amalekites had come up from the desert region and, invaded some of the Negev and captured Ziklag and captured some of the family of David and his men. But yet David leads this attack to gain them back, and that's in 1 Samuel chapter 30. Okay, so some of these times, this is a key, this is a hopefully a key in helping you read your Bible. When you read this and you see that phrase, the south, and it's talking about Beersheba or Ziklag or whatever, it's actually talking about a particular part of Israel. It's not just a general, just regional term. Okay, it's actually a reference to the Negev. Some of our modern versions will actually say the Negev in our modern versions, and you'll see that as well. Okay, so that's the Negev, and let's go ahead and go forward here. You can see the Negev is like right down in this area. This is a New Testament map, but we'll look at some of these maps here in a minute, some of these cities we're going to consider tonight. All right, here's ancient Gerar. That's the tell of the hill, the mound, the ruins of the ancient city of Gerar, where, at least as we think it is. Some of these, you know, we do our best to try to determine where they are. And some of this, sometimes they've been misidentified. Especially in the 1800s, what would happen is you'd get the British controlled this area for a while, and a British army officer or someone would say, hey, you know, I'm reading my Bible and I want to know where this place is. And he would go find a Bedouin and say, do you know where this place is? And the guy'd say, oh, sure I do. And he'd say, pay me some money and I'll show you. Well, does he have any motive to identify the right place? No, he's just trying to make a few bucks to go show you. And so he'd go show someplace and he had no idea. He just was, you know, thinking, I can find a convincing place and show this guy from England that this is it. And then so things got misidentified at times. So there's been archaeology done with these places. But you can see this is a drier area. You can see there is grass and stuff growing, but you can see it's a drier area. Acacia trees are really common in this area. And it's a drier area. And this is the ruins, we think, of ancient Gerar, that old Philistine city that this is the place where the king of Gerar, you know, said, hey, get Sarah for me as a wife, etc. So this is in the Negev. We'll go on a little further. These are the ruins of ancient Beersheba. So you can see some of it has been excavated today. And the way that archaeology is done, all right, most of our ideas of archaeology are, you know, Indiana Jones, I think, and that kind of thing, or are, you know, even some of the most famous archaeological digs, like the discovery and the excavation of the tomb of Tutankhamun in Egypt, was done very poorly by modern archaeological standards. Basically, they were just looking for how much great discovery can we find to take back to museums in Europe, and maybe private collectors, sell them to private collectors to finance the expedition. And so, so Carter discovers the tomb of Tutankhamun. And when he does, there were pieces in there that he actually damaged in the process that had sat there in that tomb for thousands of years undamaged. And because he didn't handle them well, he damaged them. Okay. Today, when archaeology is done, now you'd have to understand something. Not every archaeologist believes the Bible, and they're not looking to prove the Bible or anything of that nature. But what they do is they dig just layer after layer after layer, and they document what they find on every layer. And just about everything they find is important to them. They're not just looking for some piece of gold. If they find a bunch of fish bones somewhere, they go, hey, somebody here either sold fish or this family had a lot of fish in their diet or something. And then they start to go, you know, ask questions about how did people live. Archaeology has really moved a lot more toward what was everyday life like and away from what treasure can we find. Okay. And so they excavate these buildings, and by what they find in the buildings, they can start to determine, hey, you know, you find a building that's got a lower millstone in it and a bunch of wheat seeds that are buried in the ground, you can figure out this was probably a place where they ground flour, you know, and they find this kind of stuff. And so these are the ruins of ancient Beersheba. Here's a dry riverbed. This is a park that they have in modern Israel, and there's a dry riverbed that runs through this area. This will be a good illustration, and we'll have more pictures of them later, of a word, wadi, W-A-D-I. Okay, what a wadi is in Israel is it's a riverbed, and actually there's two different words in Hebrew for a river and a wadi. They have two different words for it. Nahal means river. Wadi is an Arabic word. So what you'd have is these wadis where when you get a rainy season, that will flow like a river. It'll have some water running in it. And sometimes it could have a significant amount of water running in it. But if something was a river, it ran year-round. In other words, it had a flow year-round. And this, again, as I've said before, is kind of the background, we believe, of Jesus' statement, the wise man built his house upon a rock and the foolish man built his house on the sand. Now, this looks like you could build your house down here. I mean, it's ground, right? Promise, if you build your house in a wadi, what does Jesus say? But when the rains come and the floods came, that house was destroyed, right? So if you build your house in the middle of the wadi when the rain season comes, the water's going to wash your house away. But if you put your house on the rock up above the wadi, then when the rains come, you'll be secure. You'll be fine. You need the right foundation, is Jesus' point in all of that, okay? So this is, again, you can see in Beersheba the palm trees and things, and that's in modern Beersheba today, all right? And then here you can see this is a modern major city in Beersheba in the south of Israel. And Beersheba to Dan, or Dan to Beersheba, is a biblical phrase to refer to all of the land of Israel, the whole land, okay? Everything in the land of Israel. Like we would say from New York to Los Angeles or from Atlantic Pacific or something like that today about the United States. Let me move on. So we've considered the Negev. Let's move on to the hill country of Judah. The hill country of Judah, we can consider five cities. And when I say Judah, I'm expanding it into the Benjamin Plateau area as well, which have Hebron, moving north, actually. Hebron, Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Ramah, and Bethel. Okay? And so we're going to consider these. I want to see them on the map. Here's Hebron. It's the highest point in the hill country here. And then you can see Jerusalem's up here. Bethlehem's just south of that, not far. You can see these fortresses, Masada here, the Herodium up here. These were fortresses that were fortified by Herod the Great when he was king. These are the major cities that we're going to look at, and then the Benjamin Plateau is up here. All right. So here I have another picture that says modern Hebron. All right. So we'll consider Hebron today. The hill country of Judah lies between the Shephelah on the west and the wilderness of Judah on the east. So let me go back, all right, and remind you. The Shephelah is these foothills right through here that have those five valleys that go up from the Philistine area up into the hill country of Judah. Okay, so it goes from the Shephelah on the west to the wilderness of Judah on the east. The wilderness of Judah is down here. Masada is in the wilderness. Okay. It is between Bethel on the north and the Negev Basin on the south. So you got the Negev Basin down here in the south, and you have Bethel up in the north. Okay, that would be the north edge of the hill country of Judah. It's about 53 miles long and ranges from 11 to 27 miles in width. I don't mean 11 to 27 miles from here to here. I mean the hills themselves. Okay. And so that is the hill country of Judah. We've got these three major areas within the hill country of Judah. And we'll consider these major cities. Hebron, which is also called Kiriath Arba, Joshua 20, verse 7, makes reference to it. And they appointed Kedesh in Galilee, in Mount Naphtali, and Shechem in Mount Ephraim, and Kiriath Arba, which is Hebron, in the mountain of Judah. Okay, and what are they appointing here? Cities of refuge, according to verse 2. So what we're going to learn is Hebron was one of the cities of refuge appointed. Let me remind you what a city of refuge was. All right, murder under the Old Testament law brought the death penalty. Okay, murder brought the death penalty. If you murdered a human being, then you faced execution yourself. However, even in our criminal justice code, there's usually some distinction between murder. And we might have some other degree of murder, or there might be manslaughter or something like that, negligent homicide or something like that, depending on whatever state you're in, how the legal code's written. I'm not an attorney, so I don't know how that all works. But I do know there's a distinction made, and that is if you're reckless and you accidentally kill somebody, you're held accountable for it, but not at the same level as if you intentionally murder them. And so in the Old Testament, if you accidentally kill somebody, one of the examples that's given, you're cutting wood. You're out, you know, cutting down some trees, and while you're swinging your axe, the head flies off your axe and kills the guy who's working next to you. You didn't mean to kill him, but you did. So what you had the opportunity to do then was to flee to the nearest city of refuge. And as long as you got into that city of refuge, you were safe from being executed. You had to stay there for the entire life of whoever was the high priest of Israel. When that high priest passed away, when he died, then no one could take revenge on you or else they would be a murderer. But you got a basically sort of like a prison sentence, but you weren't in a prison. You were able to go live in a city, but you had to leave your home and go to one of these cities. And so Hebron ended up being, and they were really six of them, three on one side and three on the other side, end up being the city's refuge where people could flee to in order to escape being, you know, somebody taking revenge and killing you because you accidentally killed their family member. Hebron is about 3,040 feet above sea level and is the highest city in Israel. Okay? It is naturally and easily defended because of the wadi system on all sides. It was a natural hub for the southern part of the hill country of Judah. Some of the major valleys lead up to it. Hebron was the home of Abraham, we can see in Genesis 13. So he was in the Negev, but as we've seen, really the Negev. Basically, this little thing on the Dead Sea, right here, on all the biblical maps, you'll see this thing that juts out in the Dead Sea. That is called the Lisan. Lisan is the Hebrew word for tongue. Okay? Today, the Lisan goes all the way across. It's because the surface of the Dead Sea has dropped because of irrigation. There's not as much water flowing into it. So there's evaporation going on. And we'll look at the Dead Sea in future weeks. But today, that goes all the way across. But even in ancient times, you could wade. It's not probably a pleasant thing, but you could wade from here because it was shallow enough at the Lisan they could wade across. And that was in an emergency. That was a way sometimes people would flee. We think that's probably how when David is being, hunted, he sends his family over to Moab, which is over on this side. Because remember, Ruth is his, he's a descendant of Ruth. She's from Moab. So he sends them over there. And probably the easiest way for them to get there instead of going all the way around the sea would be to wade across the Dead Sea there and walk across the Lisan. That's our guess at it. The Bible doesn't tell us what route they take, but that would have been the natural route to take. But if you start at this Lisan, so the Dead Sea makes a few markers for us. See the top edge of the Dead Sea? If you go from there right to the middle of the hill country, there's Jerusalem, right about even with the top of the Dead Sea, right? Top edge of the Dead Sea. Down here, if you go from the Lisan straight over, about here, that's where Beersheba is. Okay? And so what we find is that Hebron, at one point, which is just north, which is in the Negev, and just north of it is Hebron, just up the hill. Hebron ended up being an area that Abraham spent time in. Genesis 13. Verse 18 says, and Abram removed his tent and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron. And he built there an altar unto the Lord. And so we find this becomes, most of Abraham's time is spent down in this southern hill country and in the Negev. Okay? The cave of Machpelah is there. This is the burial place of Sarah, Abraham, Isaac, Rebekah, Leah, and Jacob, but it should be Jacob. Genesis 23 tells us the story of Abraham buying the land. He buys the land in order to bury his wife in. Sarah was 107 and 20 years old, and these were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, the same as in Hebron, in the land of Canaan. Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. So what we find is this is where they bury her in the cave of Machpelah. And so he negotiates for this. Verse 9, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he hath, which is in the end of his field, for as much money as it is worth, he shall give it me for possession of a burying place amongst you. This is where they end up burying Sarah, and eventually others are buried there. We can see in chapter 49, verse 31. Then they buried Abraham and there they buried Abraham and Sarah's wife, and there they buried Isaac and Rebekah, his wife, and there I buried Leah, Jacob says. Now, I've always thought this was interesting to me too, and that is that Leah is the disfavored wife, right? But yet when the time comes to be buried alongside the patriarchs, Jacob buries Leah there, recognizing her as a full wife and her full status. So, you know, after years and years of marriage, and in the early parts of that marriage, we know it doesn't go real well because he gets tricked into marrying her and all of those kinds of things. But here at the end of his life, he buries his wife Leah there alongside his grandfather and grandmother and father and mother. And I just think that's a very interesting thing to me because it seems to show something about his biblical view of marriage. In other words, it's not just about whether this is my favorite wife. Okay, this is the first woman I married. And so therefore, this is my wife, and she's the one that's buried there. Hebron was the inheritance of Caleb, Joshua 14:13. So we get to the book of Joshua, what we find is that Caleb asked for an inheritance. All right, and he says, and Joshua blessed him and gave unto Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, Hebron for an inheritance. So this becomes the area that they go and conquer, and that becomes the inheritance of Caleb, the spy who went into the land with Joshua, and they were the only two that brought back a good report. Hebron was a city of refuge. We already saw that in Joshua chapter 20, verse 7. And then Hebron was the first capital of David's kingdom, 2 Samuel 2:1. So when David is first made king, he's not made king over all Israel after Saul's death. The northern kingdoms don't necessarily, the northern tribes don't necessarily recognize David as the king, but his own tribe of Judah does. And so as we find here in 2 Samuel 2:1, it says, "It came to pass after this that David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up to any of the cities in Judah? And the Lord said unto him, go up. And David said, whither shall I go up? And he said, unto Hebron." And as we see here then in verse 11, it says, "And at that time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. For 7.5 years he reigns over the kingdom of Judah as the king of the tribe of Judah in Hebron." That becomes the capital of Judah. Okay, so let's go ahead and consider, we'll take a look at some of the pictures. Here's modern Hebron. You can see today. Now, these towns are in what politically is called the West Bank today. Okay, it's Israel, but it's the West Bank, and the majority of the people who live there are Palestinians. Okay, that's how they're often identified. But there's a whole lot of politics involved in all of that. So what you find is that this is an area that can be fairly volatile. So modern Hebron is often not on the list of places that trips to Israel often visit because it can be a pretty volatile place. I'll tell you a little history of that volatility. Here's the ruins of ancient Hebron. We can see, again, you know, different stones and things. There's not a lot there. At this picture, it's not that there's nothing there, but you can see pieces of what was the ancient city of Hebron. Here's the Cave of the Patriarchs at Hebron. Okay, this building was built over the Cave of Machpelah. There's a square building originally built here that was built in the days of Herod. Okay, so there was originally a building built there in the days of Herod. And during the time of the Byzantine Empire, so I'm going to stretch your knowledge of ancient history or world history back from high school. But during the times of the Byzantine Empire, the Byzantines were the Eastern Roman Empire. The Roman Empire got big and hard to administrate, and so they broke it into two empires, with one capital in the west in Rome and the other capital in the east in Constantinople, named after Constantine, who became the emperor of that region. And yet what happened was that city today is called Istanbul, but yet they ruled Israel. Okay, that was part of the Eastern Roman Empire. And so they actually turned this into what they call a basilica. A basilica is a name for a Roman building where they would have large gatherings. Business would be done and those kinds of things. So it was a secular Roman building is what a basilica was. But because churches started to become large after Christianity was legal within the Roman empires, it became a legal religion. It was considered appropriate to be a Christian. It wasn't a crime. Then the churches got large and they built basilicas for churches to meet in. Okay, so this was what we would call an Eastern Orthodox basilica. So you have more than one Catholic church. That's why there's a Catholic church called the Roman Catholic Church, because that's the Western Catholic Church. But in the East, you have Catholic churches that call themselves Catholic, and they are Eastern Orthodox. So you have Greek Orthodox and Russian Orthodox and Romanian Orthodox and the various different Orthodox, Armenian Orthodox and some of the other Orthodox denominations that are all in fellowship with each other as part of the Eastern. So this was an Eastern church. But then the problem is that in history, there is this man who claims to be a prophet in Arabia and becomes a prophet and warlord at the same time and starts to build a kingdom, and his followers start to become very powerful politically, and they conquer all of North Africa as well as going up into the Middle East. And when they do that, this gets turned into a mosque. This building becomes a mosque. Well, what happens is, after they control this area of the world, Christians who had been making pilgrimages to see these places find it more difficult to get to those places. And as I said before, the rulers of Western Europe decide, hey, the Muslims have been threatening us. We had to even defeat them at the Battle of Tours to keep them from coming into Central Europe and trying to take this over. And so what we need to do is we need to go and take back those lands that all these Bible stories took place in and take them back and protect them and make them safe for Christian pilgrims to be able to go there. And so they capture Hebron. They capture Jerusalem, and they capture much of Israel during the Crusades. And so guess what? This becomes a church again. But then a man named Saladin comes along. Saladin is a very powerful Muslim general, and Saladin comes along, and he drives out the crusaders, the Christian crusaders, and he drives them out and turns it back into a mosque. And since the time of Saladin, it has served as a mosque. And you can see even today, there is construction that goes on in and around this place. However, the nation of Israel took possession of this location. The country, the modern country of Israel, took possession of this location and split it in half so that half of it was a synagogue and half of it a mosque. But on a day of Friday prayers, a Jewish man, angered, went in with a rifle, and while Muslims were on the ground praying, opened fire, active shooter kind of situation, opened fire on them. Well, that set the Palestinians in Hebron, you know, off. And all kinds of things started to happen in retaliation for that. And ever since then, that happened in the 90s, ever since then, Hebron has been a very volatile place. It's probably one of the more volatile cities as far as the Palestinian influence. And so it's not a place that you often would get to go see if you were to visit Israel today. But, you know, that's just, you can see how volatile this has been from Herod to the Eastern Roman Empire to, Muslim conquest to crusaders to Muslims taking it back over to the modern state of Israel. And there's been lots and lots and lots of bloodshed over controlling places like this. But this is the place. And it's really amazing to think about. I don't know that, you know, you ever in your life get to go see it. But this building is built over the place where Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebecca and Jacob and Leah were buried. And so that's the Cave of the Patriarchs at Hebron. Now we're going to look here. I don't know how well you can see this, but here's Hebron, okay? Let get you an idea how close. See, this is the box of the area we're looking at. So here's Hebron, and if you go north from here, you can see Bethlehem up here. And not too far from there, you're going to get up to Jerusalem, okay? And you got all these various other small cities in and around the area. That you hear referenced in the Bible, if you read your Bible. But so Hebron, we're going to now move from there, and we're going to move to the north, up the ridge. Can you see this ridge? Okay. And these really the ridge is more like here because that's the road. But you can see as we look at the names of these places, here's Lachish and stuff. You got the Shvelah, and then you got the kind of the edge here, and then you get up here into the central hill country in Hebron and Bethlehem along this ridge. And so we're going to move up to Bethlehem next. So let's consider Bethlehem. Bethlehem is about 6 miles south of Jerusalem. It has several biblical names. Ephrath, Genesis 35. Let's look at Genesis 35. And Genesis 35:19 says, "And Rachel died and was buried in the way to Ephrath, which is Bethlehem." Now Rachel, Jacob's favorite wife, died in childbirth, giving birth to Benjamin, the youngest son of Jacob. And they were near Bethlehem in Ephrath, and she was buried there near Bethlehem. It's also called Bethlehem Ephrata, Micah 5:2. Here's that famous prophecy of the Messiah being born. Remember I talked about how God does what he says? Micah 5:2. "But thou, Bethlehem Ephrata, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of thee shall he come forth unto me that is to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth have been from of old, from everlasting." So what do we see here? Here's a prophecy hundreds of years before Jesus, prophesying that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. All right, and Bethlehem in Judah, 1 Samuel 17:12. We find this is a common word for it. The book of Ruth, we're going to see here, is another example of it. But 1 Samuel 17:12. "And the Philistines gathered together their armies." Excuse me, I'm in verse 1. 17:12, but it's in the context of Goliath. "And now David was the son of that Ephrathite, an Ephrathite of Bethlehem Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had 8 sons. And so we find here that David is from Bethlehem in Judah, 1 Samuel 17. Rachel was buried near Bethlehem. We saw that in Genesis 35:19. Bethlehem was the home of Naomi and her husband. And later, Ruth and Boaz married and lived there. Let's go to the book of Ruth very briefly. In Hebrew, I remember when I was studying Hebrew in seminary, and Ruth is actually pretty easy Hebrew as far as language goes. It's fairly basic vocabulary, so it's one of the first things that you kind of work on translating when you've studied enough Hebrew. Now, it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country. Now, the reason I'm telling you about it being easy Hebrew is because you get to that verse, and you get to a word you know, Beth. Beth means house. It's used thousands of times in the Old Testament, thousands of times. And then you get to another word. It's a really common vocabulary word that you memorize, Lechem, which means bread. So Bethlehem means house of bread. Now, here's the problem. There was a famine in the land, and this family living in the house of bread has to flee and go somewhere else because there's no food in the house of bread. Now, when a place is called the house of bread, now I realize there are some places that are named, and you kind of scratch your head about why they're named that. Okay, you know, you might, you know, you have the name of somewhere, and you go, I don't really know why they named it that. That almost seems ironic. But Bethlehem isn't that. There are plenty of good fields in and around Bethlehem. And we do know from the story of Ruth and Boaz that there was plenty of farmland there. This was a good place to grow crops and to farm and to keep your sheep and goats and things. And so this is the house of bread. So what this should tip us off to is something's really wrong when people living in the house of bread have to go somewhere else to find food. And what we know is that it's in the days of the judges. And we know that in the days of the judges, God had brought judgment on Israel for their idolatry. And so what this is telling us is, if you know the story of the judges, during one of those times when God's judgment was on Israel, this family finds no food in Bethlehem and they leave. And they went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. All right. And it's interesting because the Old Testament says that a Moabite is not to enter the congregation of the Lord up to the 10th generation. And what that means is never, never intermarry with Moabites. And what do these two young men do? Intermarry with Moabites. But God overrules that, and he, one of the most righteous women examples in the Old Testament, Ruth, ends up being Ruth the Moabitess. And throughout this book, how is she referred to? Ruth the Moabitess, Ruth the Moabitess, Ruth the Moabitess. She's one of the four women listed in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew. But yet, you know, her whole reputation is she's Ruth from that place where all those wicked people live, the Moabites. Okay, and if you know a little bit about the ancient history of Israel, the Moabites are descendants of Lot and his daughter. Remember the story of Sodom and Gomorrah and he has children by his daughters? That's where they come from. And they were very, very idolatrous, and they practiced some very terrible things in their idolatrous practices, including human sacrifice. And so these were people who were full, sold-out idolaters. And so the Lord's saying, don't intermarry with these people. But yet this happens, and God uses it to eventually bring along the Messiah, right? But yet this takes place in Bethlehem. So the promise is the Messiah is going to be born here. And here we find that, you know, Ruth eventually marries Boaz. And it's interesting, the comments of the women. Verse 14 of the end of the book. And the woman said unto Naomi, blessed be the Lord, which hath not left thee this day without a kinsman. That is somebody to take care of you if you're widowed, that his name may be famous in Israel, and he shall be unto thee a restorer of thy life, and a nourisher of thine old age, for thy daughter-in-law, which loveth thee, which is better to thee than seven sons, has borne him. God has given you a grandchild here who's going to take care of you in your old age. And your daughter-in-law has given birth to him, and this is a great blessing from God. And then we learn, verse 18, now these are the generations of Perez. Perez begat Hezron, and Hezron begat Ram, and Ram begat Amminadab, and Amminadab begat Nashon, and Nashon begat Salmon, and Salmon begat Boaz. So here's the Boaz we meet in the book. And Boaz begat Obed, and Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David. And so we find here in the line of David, and then ultimately in the line of Christ, is Boaz and Ruth. And so these events take place in and around Bethlehem. And Bethlehem was the home of David's family, as we saw in 1 Samuel 17 and 1 Samuel 16 tells the same story. And Bethlehem, as we know, is the birthplace of Jesus, Luke chapter 2. Luke 2. It came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Quirinius was governor of Syria, and all went to be taxed, everyone into his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee out of the city of Nazareth into Judea, unto the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary's espoused wife, being great with child. And so it was that while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn. And so this is the location of the birth of Christ. Okay? So we're going to consider here. Here's a view of modern day Bethlehem, a view from the Church of the Nativity, which is built over the site, the basic site of where Jesus was born. Now, again, if you go to Israel today, Bethlehem is not always on the list because, again, it's a fairly volatile place. I found this photo online, and this is a Hamas rally. Hamas is a group that is a militant Palestinian group that is very anti-Israeli. In the Hamas charter, they say that their ultimate goal is the destruction of the state of Israel. So their only goal, this is why it's hard to negotiate with somebody like that. If somebody came to our church and said, our goal is to kill everybody in your church, how would you find middle ground with that? You can kill half of us? You know what I'm saying? There's not much, it's not very easy to negotiate with that kind of situation. And so they're very militant, and this is a Hamas rally in the streets of Bethlehem. And so it makes it sometimes a volatile place, and it's not always a safe place for people to go and see the Church of the Nativity. All right, here's the exterior of the Church of the Nativity. And in a minute, I'm going to show you a picture of this door right here. Okay? There's actually two churches on this site, the Church of the Nativity, which is an Eastern Orthodox church, and then right next to it and joined to it is the Church of St. Catherine, which is a Roman Catholic church. Okay, because remember, they're not the same denomination, so they both want to be on that site, and so they have two joined churches right next to each other there. This is the door, the entrance to the Church of the Nativity right there. All right, now, I don't know how well you can see it on this, but actually, you see this line right there? The door used to be bigger. What happened was, when the Muslim invaders came and conquered Bethlehem, inside the Church of the Nativity, on the walls, there were representations of the Magi coming to the birth of Jesus. And what do the Magi look like? Like Middle Eastern, right? And so they came in and they saw all these Magi on the walls and thought, this honors our people, the people that we're from. And they didn't recognize it as a church, and so they didn't destroy it. But once they discovered that it was a church, what they did is they turned it into a barn. And they would keep their camels and horses and stuff in there. And the doors were big enough to do that. When the Christians got control of it during the Crusades again, they made the door much smaller. You actually have to crouch down to get in through that door. Because they didn't ever want anybody to ride a horse or a camel in that door again. So they wanted to make sure no animals could get through that door. So that door's been made smaller over the years, okay? And again, this church was built in like the 4th century originally. And the way that these sites were often found was that in the earliest days of Christianity, people were going to these places to see where Jesus was born or these kinds of things. And that interestingly, as the Romans persecuted Christians, one of the things they would do to try to scare Christians away from these places is build a shrine very near it to a false god, like a temple to Jupiter or something on the site, so that way the Christians wouldn't show up. But it actually has worked in the favor of finding some of these places, because what it does is it says, well, why would the Romans want to build that here? Because you're going back to the 2nd century and the Romans are building a temple to Jupiter there, you know, within 100 years of the event, because they're trying to scare the Christians off. So we're pretty confident this is the general area. There's a mark on the floor that I'm going to show you in a minute that's supposedly the place. That's complete guess. There's no way they're going to know this is. I don't think Mary ever came back by there and said, yeah, put this big silver star right here. That's where he was born. Okay. Here's the floor of the Byzantine church. They've kind of elevated it to maintain this mosaic, but you can see the beautiful mosaic work that's all throughout the church. During the Roman period, mosaic art with the tile was very, very common in flooring. Even sidewalks in wealthy cities were made out of mosaic. And think about that. These are all small little tiles that make these designs, and this is in the Church of the Nativity. This is what they call the altar in the Church of the Nativity. It's an Eastern Orthodox church, so you can see the icons and things. And I have to be honest with you, you know, as Americans, this isn't what we do with our historical places, generally. And so you come into these places as an American Christian tourist, a Christian pilgrim, and you go, this feels, you know, for those of us who are, you know, against images because they seem idolatrous, because they are, we come and look at this and go, this doesn't feel very spiritual. Okay? And so we're thinking, why would you, I want to see what it looked like when Jesus was born here. Why'd you build this shrine over it? All right? But honestly, as Baptists, we probably would have built condos or something. I don't know. I'm not sure what we would have done with it. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, the different people through different eras have done different things to commemorate these places. And they don't always feel the way you want them to feel. Okay, now we're down in the shrine itself. You go down some stairs. If I remember right, there's stairs over here. And you go down those stairs and you get down into the cave system that's underneath the church. And you'll see this shrine. There's curtains up and incense burning. And down here on the floor, I'm going to have a picture of it in just a minute, is the silver star that marks the supposed spot where Jesus was born. Now, so you see, this was the cave, I'm sure, you know, didn't have a marble floor when Mary went and stayed there with, you know, all of that. But they put a marble floor in. They have this silver star on the floor. You can see the incense burners and all of these kinds of things there. Whether this is the actual location, probably not the exact same spot, but within the caves that are underneath this church is almost certainly the place where Jesus was born. Okay, so again, you go down here, and it's kind of neat to see this place, but again, on the other hand, it just feels very, you know, shrine-ish. And if you're not Eastern Orthodox, it doesn't say to you, hey, this is a place of worship. It just feels like I'm in a foreign place of worship. Okay, but this is an extensive cave system. And actually, if you go to the caves that go underneath the Church of St. Catherine, you'll find another cave. And this is the cave of St. Jerome, what they call St. Jerome. Jerome actually translated the Bible by the time you get into the 300s in the Roman Empire. By the mid-300s, most people in the Western Empire couldn't speak Greek anymore. And they had started using Latin, and so they needed the Bible translated into Latin. And there were many Latin translations, but there were so many, some were good and some were bad, that Jerome, who was a scholar, was asked to translate the Bible into Latin and make a standardized translation. It became known as the Vulgate, which means the common translation. And this is the cave we believe he worked in. Now, here's what happened. Was he translated the New Testament from Greek into Latin, completed that work, and then he started translating the Psalms from the Greek Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, into Latin. And then he realized, you know, it would be better if I could work from the Hebrew. But in that era, the rabbis had agreed that they would never teach a Christian Hebrew. So what he did is he found a rabbi nearby that he bribed into teaching him Hebrew. And he learned to read Hebrew so he could translate from Hebrew into Latin and not from the secondary translation into a third level translation into Latin. And so he worked in this cave. Now the legend says if you ever see images of Jerome, one thing you'll see is there's almost always a human skull near him. Because according to legend, and this may be true, he kept a human skull on his desk while he worked. Not because he was some kind of gruesome guy, but they were a lot closer to death than we are. They didn't have professional undertakers and things. But if you had a family member die, it was the family's job to make sure they got buried, which meant you took care of the body. Okay, so to them, you know, skeletons, they didn't have Halloween, so they weren't afraid of skeletons and things like that. So, you know, he did the work with a skull on his desk to remind him that he was going to be that skull someday, and that he ought to spend his life in such a way that when he's just a skull, that he'll have thanked God and he's honored God with his life. And so he worked in this cave system translating the Bible into Latin. And he used to communicate with another well-known theologian of the time, a man named Augustine. St. Augustine in Florida is named after him. And one of the things he used to give Augustine a hard time about is, well, you wouldn't understand this because it's in Hebrew. Because Jerome was one of the only Christians in the world at the time that knew any Hebrew. And so he would give a hard time to Augustine. Here, outside the Church of St. Catherine, you see they have an image. See the skull? That's, you know, that's Jerome. There's St. Catherine. I don't know the legends about her, but that's the Roman Catholic Church that sits over this site in Bethlehem. Okay. Now we're also in Bethlehem, and we're in what is, there's a little chapel in this area, but it's called the Shepherd's Cave. And these are the places that shepherds in Bethlehem would shelter in bad weather. And so this would be the kind of place where shepherds would be sheltering. And while they're sheltering there, angels could appear to them in the sky, you know, or near here. They'd have their clocks out and they could appear to them in the sky and say, I bring you good tidings of great joy. So this is the area that that took place in. Again, you know, these things have been, they're caves, but they've been turned into shrines in many cases. These are the fields in and around Bethlehem. And these are the fields where the shepherds would graze their flocks. So if you want to imagine it a little bit, imagine the angels up here while the shepherds are on these hills. And the angels say to them, we bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. Okay, so that's all. Now think about this. What did God say? But thou, Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be small among the thousands of Judah, out of you shall come the one whose goings forth have been from old, from everlasting. In other words, Bethlehem is the place where the Messiah is going to be born. Right? Abraham, through you all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And yet, where is that one born? Jesus is born in Bethlehem. And through him, all the nations of the earth are blessed. In these places is where God kept those promises. Okay? Now, if you notice, I have a lot more notes here. And I'm not going to try to trudge through the rest of them tonight. I bit off more than I could chew as far as notes go. You'll notice Jerusalem is in this hill country of Judah area. And we're going to do a whole series on Jerusalem itself, probably a couple weeks on Jerusalem itself, because so many things take place in Jerusalem. But we're going to go ahead and we'll take a break here. And I'm going to be out of town next week. My family's going to go up to Michigan and visit family and have a vacation up there. But the following Sunday, Lord willing, we'll be back and we'll pick up here in the hill country of Judah. But again, I want us to remember, we have a Heavenly Father who keeps his promises. And we have visual evidence of it in these places. Where God said, I'm going to make you a great nation. And the descendants of Abraham live in that land right now. Now, they haven't inherited it in the full promise. Okay? Because when they inherit it in the full promise, God will be their God and they will be his people. And right now, they're not following the Lord. Many of them are atheists and other things. But what we find is, here's these places that God, for the thousands of years, has kept those promises. Whether it's 4,000 years ago with Abraham, whether it's, you know, 2,500 years ago in Micah, whether it's, you know, or... You know, throughout all these ages, here are the places where God has kept his promises. And we thank the Lord for that. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we do thank you for this.